Welcome, everybody, to another live edition of Double Cross Radio, coming to you from the state of Jefferson, or the Jefferson Republic, or just Jefferson, from wherever we are. And I'm joined tonight by my co-host, Drew Lamb. Drew, how you doing?
I am live from the sovereign nation of me.
Excellent.
I wasn't sure who was bringing us in, me or you. So
I wasn't either. I forgot to discuss that. But I just took the bull by the horns there. Anyway, we have we were planning on having Dennis Linthicum join us tonight. Evidently, something has come up, and Dennis was not able to join us. And maybe it was on my line. I had a bad email address, possibly. So, and he didn't get my message today. So it could be my problem, not his. And so, if that's the case, I apologize, Dennis. We will get it straightened out. We'll have him on again soon. We love Dennis. He's an awesome commenter on all things, and I think this topic would be one that he would have enjoyed speaking about. But before we get into today's topic, let's just kind of find out what's going on here in this area. Drew, how's things going in the aquaponics industry?
Well, there's lots of innovation going on right now. I mean, sky's the limit, you know, with what people can do. I am actually developing systems that are going to allow me to produce more microgreens using aquaponics systems, and that's just solely due to my own needs and my customers' needs. I sell a lot of microgreens to local restaurants, and I need to increase production and also improve efficiency and consistency, and reduce some of my costs, like heating and lights and things like that. And so I've been working with John Cross from Aquaponic Tech to develop new and improved systems that we'll be rolling out. We're also designing a new system for my home greenhouse right now. So I decided that I was switching that out to aquaponics because I was doing soil culture in there for several years. And it's a lot of work doing soil culture. You have to change your soil, and I'd been really pushing it with adding things like, you know, worm castings and other nutrients to my soil and watering teas and things like that. But you get to a point where you have salt and mineral buildup and pests and things and diseases in that soil, and you've got to shovel it all out and get some more or mix up some more and start again. And you could spend hundreds of dollars. I think with the soil that I had in my greenhouse, initially cost $800 for good organic potting soil that was in there. And now I have a huge composting operation going on at my farm, and so I could produce a lot of material that can go into making my own soil, but it's still it's a massive amount of work and shoveling out those beds, mixing up more soil, putting it back into the raised beds. I just decided that I wanted to switch it out to aquaponics. That way my fish are producing the fertilizer and I'm not shoveling dirt around all the time. And so what we're doing in there is we're going to have a 275-gallon IBC tote container that'll hold the fish. There's going to be an external filtration system that will remove the solid fish waste from the system. You really don't need a lot of nutrients to grow plants in an aquaponic system. And what happens if you let your plants in gravel, for example, which is often done, that provides the filtration, removes the fish solids, the solid waste from the water, and returns it back to the fish clean. But the problem with that is that after a while, that solid waste starts to build up. The plants can't handle solid material. They handle liquid material. And what happens is that material starts to build up, and it takes a lot of oxygen to make it decompose, and you also end up with anaerobic zones, which are really, really bad to have, and that affects all kinds of things. So you end up with low oxygen, nutrients that aren't available to the plants because of the anaerobic environment, and ultimately you end up having to shovel out all that gravel and replacing it. Then that messes up your biofiltration and the bacteria in your system, and you could lose fish because of it. And so what we're doing is we're moving out of the aquaponics stone age and using external filtration systems that we're building out of recycled plastic drums, and building things like swirl filters, settling tanks, degassing tanks, and things like this to handle that waste outside of the media beds.
Then you got like a miniature sewage treatment system going on there.
Exactly, and so then the water goes through the media bed. So I'm still going to have a gravel bed, because there's a few things that I want to grow that I'll need that, you know, like tomatoes and peppers, you know, things like that. And also, the beneficial bacteria that will process the ammonia waste in the water that's not in a solid form, that needs to go through something, you know. And so gravel works really good to host the beneficial bacteria. There's a lot of different kinds of aerobic bacteria that make things work in an aquaponics system, but primarily you've got two or three varieties. You've got Nitrosomonas and Spironoma bacteria and Nitrobacter. And sorry, it's been a long day. I'm a little punchy. And so, anyways, these will live on the gravel. And so when the water passes through there, that will convert the ammonia into nitrite. And then another form of bacteria will convert that nitrite into nitrate. And that's what your plants are going to use basically for fertilizer so that they can grow. But this system is really going to be a hot rod system. So I'm going to have the media bed with gravel, but I'm also going to have a container where I'll be doing deep water culture. So I'll have floating rafts made out of expanded polystyrene, and that will have some net pots in it that will have a media in there like rock wool or gravel, and the roots will grow down into the water in that tank, and like greens will do really well, like lettuces grow really well using that technique. And then I still want to do some crops, some root crops like onions. And
so you're actually holding the rocks underwater, but as a place for the roots to kind of,
yeah, like the system I have at the farm. We see those floating rafts, and I usually have basils and some microgreens,
mm-hmm.
even grown tobacco using that method. And so I'll have a container for that, and that works really well for growing greens. And then, but I want to be able to grow root crops. you know, how do you grow a sweet potato with aquaponics? How do you grow onions with aquaponics? You know, these are things that you typically cannot enjoy if you engage in aquaponics. So what I learned from Murray Hallam in an interview on Off Grid Journey a few weeks ago was that I could still grow those things, and you use a wicking bed. And so we'll be adding a wicking bed to the system, which will be another container, and that will have some pipe running through the bottom of it that's perforated, and the aquaponics water will circulate through there, and it'll leach into some media that will absorb the water and then wick it up into a layer of dirt up on the top where the crops will be growing. And so I'll be able to grow carrots and radishes and potatoes and things like that, and be doing aquaponics at the same time. Now,
that's so cool.
The best part of this is that I just got this installed last night, is that this whole thing is off grid. I have a 400 watt solar power system that's in my garden shed just above the greenhouse. And so I ran a circuit off of that to the greenhouse. And I've got a DC pump that will be running off of that, and did the math, and it looks like with the current setup that I have, I'll be able to run that pump consistently, nonstop, 24/7, totally off of solar power. So this whole thing is going to be off-grid. And ultimately, this will be how I scale up my farm. But ultimately, this is just a model of how the farm will be in the future. And so I'm very excited. This is a huge step forward, you know, where we're going off grid, we're building more resilient aquaponic systems that better process the waste and produce healthier fish and are less prone to have problems that kill fish. And this is all being done in a small little greenhouse that measures about 10 feet by 11 feet.
Wow.
So, yeah. Please.
So you're going to create or produce potentially a lot of food value in 100 square feet.
Oh, yeah. I've been growing in that greenhouse for several years now, pushing 4 years in that greenhouse, and it has produced a lot of food for me over the years. Another thing I'll do in there just to expand my grow space is I will do some more soil culture and hanging containers overhead, just because my greenhouse is tall and I have the room to do it. And I could do that in fall through spring, you know, winter too, if I add a little bit of heat. But in the summer it doesn't work out too well because it gets too hot up there, and up in the higher parts of the greenhouse it could just get too hot, and it cooks things pretty quickly up there, like in August. You know, where it could get up to 120 degrees up there, pretty easy.
Yeah.
And I've got a fan that pulls air, that ventilates, and you know, kicks on if it gets at about 90 degrees. I have that kick on, and it's also set if the humidity gets too high, that kicks on too. So I'm really happy to be making this switch. The downside is that it's not productive for me right now. You know, that we don't have anything growing in there, but I do have my aquaponics system out on my patio right now, and I have celery and kohlrabi and kale and chard growing out there. And even now when it's really cold, it's out there, and I've got some bluegill in there. I've got about 1,200 bluegill out there. They're still kind of small, maybe next year, maybe next fall, we'll get to harvest some and fire up the barbecue. But they're growing, but they're outgrowing the containers they're in, and that's another reason why I wanted to switch out the greenhouse to aquaponics, because I need another large container to move some of those fish in, because they're growing, and there's a lot of them.
Yep. And that, well, all that, actually, I find that really fascinating, all this stuff you're doing, and I... for those of you out there that wonder, you know, why would anyone want to go through all this trouble? Well, you know, the money you don't spend at the grocery store because you grow it yourself, they can't tax you on that yet. And that's so you don't have to be out there on the slave labor camp making tax revenue for the government all the time. You can, you know, you can cut down on the amount that you need to earn, stay below a taxation level to some extent, and still have good, healthy food to eat. So that's just something that's out there.
And, it, you know, if it hits the fan and there's no grocery stores, or if we have, you know, really bad weather and trucks can't get, you know, through I-5, you know, we live in an area here that can be isolated pretty easily. There could be an earthquake, major storms, you know, this
Ebola outbreak.
Yeah, there's several events that could occur that would totally isolate us. And yeah. The grocery stores will run out of food in a matter of days, probably about 3 days. So It's good. Another thing, too, is that it's fun. I really enjoy growing food.
Yeah,
it's very fulfilling.
I like working outside with the plants. We have a 26 square foot garden. It's not much. It's just basically a flower bed that we decided we would grow tomatoes instead of flowers in. And so we grow tomatoes, and we have some lemongrass and some spearmint and what else do we grow out there? We tried peppers. They didn't work very well. I don't know what was. I think there was a bug that got in there that messed up with the peppers. But anyway, we've out of that 26 square feet, we get a couple hundred dollars worth of food every year. So it's a lot of fun to do. And like I said, it's $200 that doesn't end up being siphoned, a part of it being siphoned off by the government.
Well, you grow some darn fine tomatoes, Chuck.
Yeah, so far. I was going to also, before we get into our road discussion, talk about a couple things we had on our Facebook page. And I only bring these up because they're just outstanding memes and comments, and hardly anybody sees them because Facebook buries them. I think they bury anything that has Murray Rothbard's name on it. And Drew posted a meme yesterday evening. And it's a quote by Murray Rothbard. There are only two ways to organize an economy. One is by freedom and voluntary choice, the way of the market. The other is by force and dictation, the way of the state. And that is just a basic truth that we should all use and consider in every time we are evaluating our present situation, because everything we do is because of force and dictation of our government masters, or the self-appointed government masters. And we have very little freedom and voluntary choice left in our lives. And so anytime you have a chance to expand that a little bit, you should take that choice, and you should stand up for anybody who's taking that choice. And I think that was a really great meme, and I wish more people had seen it. It says it only reached 11 people, which is just a crime. And I shared that on my own page because I thought it was outstanding, and I wrote a long thing about Murray Rothbard on there as an introduction to it. And with that share, the people that were reached went from 8 to 11. Now I have over 1,700 people that are my Facebook friends. And even by their own metrics, at least 30 or 40 of them should have seen that. Yeah. But only 11 people were reached. I did it during prime time today too. And it's just something that's going on with Facebook. They are really being used to politically censor things that they don't want out there. So that must mean that it's the truth, because that's the one thing they fear the most, is the truth.
Well, while you're going off on Facebook, you know, I'd like to add that every Thursday, just before our show, I get blocked from Facebook. Every Thursday. This has been going on for about 2 years, and it only happens on Thursday, and it's only right before our show. And now I'm just used to it. It happened again today. I go to log on. I was going to pimp our show. Bam. Can't log on.
All right. Yeah. And so, you know, we post some other things. Some of them are okay. Some of them were not. And I get up to I kind of cheat a little bit every once in a while. I'll post something and share it to the Jefferson State News, because I know that they have about 20,000 people subscribe to that, which is amazing. Elizabeth Bradley needs a tip of the hat for all she's done to organize that. She's made a fabulous Facebook page. But even that, if you share something to there that gets seen by people, just one thing, it should get, I would say at least 1,000 views, just boom, like that. Well, it's up to 1,200 now, but It's been shared 18 times. With 18 shares, this should be at about 10,000.
Yeah.
And so this is something else that's being suppressed. Mm-hmm. And this was just a little thing. It was from a blog back in March that one of the contributors at Mises.org, Butler Schaefer, had written an essay about secession and how it's morally the right thing to do. It's the peaceful solution to a conflict that can't be resolved. And it's really a lot of morality involved, and it's a great read. I thoroughly enjoyed reading that this morning, and I was so impressed by it. I have to put this on here. And I said, I'm going to share it with Jefferson State, even though they don't want us to use the secession word, because it's such an awesome essay. And like I said, 1,200 people got reached by it. And this is something that I'm sure it should be, with 18 shares, it should be at 10,000. And so they're suppressing the message of freedom. And so if you guys are wondering what's happening, well, maybe we need to go find another platform to share our ideas about freedom within, so we can get a better circulation of those ideas. But that was just a couple things I had to get off my chest. Facebook is kind of like a necessary evil, or something we're going to try and replace as soon as we can with another way to alert people to stuff that's going on. I think it's being used by people who want to advance the cause of statism and keep people preoccupied with kitten videos instead of things that really matter in their lives.
Yeah, but those kitten videos really help to take the edge off,
Yeah, see, when my wife's in a bad mood, she watches them and she's not in a bad mood anymore. So they do have value. I'm not going to say they have no value.
You know, Will Grigg shares a lot of them, and it does. You know, after watching a few videos from a Cop Block and some of the others, it's, you know, you start to get a little riled up. So
yeah,
a few kid videos, help.
Yeah. Well, anyway, I won't be totally down on the kitten videos, but and you could say the same thing about people that watch football games and stuff instead of, you know, really paying attention to what's really important. It's the bread and circuses thing where they make sure you have some food on the table and you have some entertainment at home, and then they can get away with whatever they want because you're not paying attention to the real problems anymore. And so that's probably enough of my griping and complaining. I'm in too good of a mood to be too sour today. But we have a topic to discuss tonight, and I think it's going to be interesting for all of you. Stay tuned for this. We want to really look at who builds the roads, and are they still going to be built in the future if things change? And are there going to be roads in the future? And what's the future of the car? And there's a lot of things in there. So we're going to get right into it. First question that came to my mind on this topic is, how do we make roads today? How are they built today? How do they choose where a road is going to go? What route it'll go to get from point A to point B? How they choose that route? How do they figure out how much it's going to cost? How they purchase the property they need to purchase? There's a lot of questions like that. Maybe you don't ever think of these questions like I do, but how does all that stuff work? Well, I happen to have some personal experience with two people that I know that had one of them had his business in the direct line of a proposed new road up in the Seattle area, and the other one was my brother who had his house square in the it was actually exactly where the road was going to go, and so he was both those people. The governments involved used eminent domain to remove them from their properties, compensated, of course, but although I don't think they got full market value for their properties. And then there were other property owners, of course, that had to be eminent domained, and they were also compensated. So there's a cost involved, but there's no voluntary exchange. They give you the price, and you take it, or you go to court and spend a lot more money than they're going to give you to try and get them to give you a little bit more. So there's really, you don't have a bargaining chip. There's no voluntary exchange at all. This is what you're getting, and so it's a forced sale. And sometimes, if it's a highway that goes for quite a ways between places. There's going to have to be areas where people can exit and get gas, or maybe stop at a motel and get a night's rest, or stop and get something to eat, or whatever. And in those areas, the real estate values go up quite a bit, where if there's going to be an exit right there. So people who maybe know that this road's going to be going through, they go in there and they buy up some of this land that's around where those exits might be, and then the values go up and they can build all these different amenities on those properties and rent them out to restaurant chains and gas stations and convenience stores and things like that, and they make a lot of money. Dennis Hastert, who's a former Speaker of the House, he's a congressman from Oklahoma, I believe it was Oklahoma, he's a former high school wrestling coach, went to Congress with a net worth under $1 million and left with a net worth in excess of $20 million. And he did it by buying property along a major freeway route. So, I mean, that's and I think that the decisions of where that route was going to go had a lot to do with the fact that Denny Hastert was well-connected with the people that were planning that route. And that's how it works. So in a political society, and one like we have today, there's a lot of graft and corruption involved. When the Transcontinental Railroad was put through, there was a tremendous amount of graft and corruption and ways to steal money from the taxpayers. It hasn't changed now that we're building roads for cars instead of railroads. It's the same problems, and there's more of them, so maybe it's diluted a little bit, or it's more common. We become more used to it, but it's still a horrible evil that's perpetrated on the taxpayer, because it all comes back to costing you more money. Because I can tell you that Denny Hastert didn't get eminent domained. And he wasn't just given an offer. He told them how much they were going to pay him if they were going to take Amy's property, and he told them where those exit ramps were going to be, because that's where he planned to have these developments that he was going to make a lot of money on. And so he was able to make the system work for him at your expense. And thank God he's no longer serving in Congress. So that's kind of how they decide to build the roads, and that's kind of the criteria that gets used. Sometimes it's to alleviate traffic flows or to change traffic flows, and a lot of times it's just kind of arbitrary. Anyway, how are they paid for? That was the next question I'm kind of thinking of. And I've always just assumed that gasoline taxes paid for all the roads. So it was kind of a fairly fair system until I started to think about it some more. And I realized that, no, there's a lot of inequity here in having the people who buy the gasoline pay for the roads. Because, first of all, the people who have the least amount of money or least able to afford gasoline are usually living furthest away from the city or the place where they work, because they have to have more and more rural areas in which to live in order to be able to afford to live there. So down in Southern California, for instance, people, it's very common to have a one-hour commute both ways. Some of them even go further than that. The police and fire departments in the Bay Area, a lot of them have purchased homes where the off-duty officers and firemen can sleep in between their work shifts, because it's too expensive. They live so far away, it's too hard for them to go home and then come back to work the next day. And they can't afford to pay them anymore, and they can't afford to live in the area where they work, because it's just too, the cost of living is too high there. So, there's a lot of people that are in those kinds of situations where driving is a major expense, and they're generally the people that can least afford a higher gasoline tax. The U.S. average on gasoline taxes right now is 55 cents a gallon. In Oregon, we're just under that average. Our average gasoline taxes are run around just under 50 cents a gallon. California, it's approximately 67 cents a gallon, which is one of the highest in the nation. No surprise there. anyway, I would figure with the number of states there are and how much gasoline gets pumped through the pump, how many millions of gallons gets pumped every day, that 50 cents a gallon should be plenty to fund all these roads. But the fact is that the roads are so poorly capitalized or maintained or whatever. The expenses of running them are so far, so much exceed the amount of revenue they get from gasoline taxes that the road system is basically going bankrupt on the system. They do not have any money. They're running out of money just as they get the next line of tax revenues come in. It's just paying the past due bills that they had before. They really have no depreciating faster than they can fix it, as I guess is the best way to put it. So they're going bankrupt. Our bridges are in horrible shape. They have a lot of bridges that are ready to fall down. Some of them are dangerously unsafe. And they probably weren't built to last long enough in the first place. And yes, you can build them to last longer. I was just down in the Yucatan Peninsula and saw Chichen Itza is built by the Mayans using no mortar, just stones fit together precisely. It was built over 1,000 years ago. It's still rock solid standing there. It's except for the parts where the Spanish destroyed part of it. But yeah, you can build stuff to last for a long time if you're a master builder. And they could do it if they wanted to spend the money. But all this money that's flowing in, I have these sneaking suspicions, and I did some basic research on it, that there are a lot of people working in administrative areas in these road, these state road, I don't know what they call them, divisions, I guess. Like in Oregon, they're called ODOT, Oregon Department of Transportation. California, I think it's CDOT, maybe. I don't know. But they have a similar organization, and the people that work in the management area, the bureaucracy part of it, they're just loaded down with middle managers and layers of middle managers between the person in charge and the people doing the work. And all these people are making, with benefits, probably $100,000 plus a year. And just this, I did one state. I just picked Oklahoma because I was looking at stuff on Denny Hastert. And so I checked to see what they had for roads since I was already in their system. And they had 222 administrative bureaucrats working in their system. And then all of them were, I don't know exactly how much their retirement benefits or whatever, but the lowest base salary that anybody got was $60,000 a year. It's just, I'm sure with all the other benefits that it's costing them at least $100,000 per person. So that's $22 million just right there in the state of Oklahoma, which isn't a huge populous state. And you could just take that problem on. There's probably hundreds of billions of dollars being wasted in this manner, that if there were private companies, they wouldn't be wasting that kind of money. They'd be using it for investments in infrastructure and machinery and paying their workers what they should be paid. They wouldn't have these state guaranteed pensions that nobody's going to be able to pay for. In fact, if you're someone living on a state pension, I would seriously look into getting a part-time job doing something, because that may not be here in 10 years. You may not have it through the end of your life. You may be living with your children, having to move back in with your children or something, because there's a lot of states that are teetering on the edge of bankruptcy, and California being one of them, and Oregon not that far behind California. So all these things I'm talking about are kind of aside. They're getting away from the thing about the roads, but we've got to get back to roads, so I will. But that's how the state maintains and builds their roads. And they have a lot of, just like they do with education, in New York, the state school system has, I think is over, oh, Tom Woods just talked about this on his podcast with somebody. They had 10 times the number of administrators that the Catholic school, that's per student, that the Catholic school system had. Both of them were large administrative units, but they had 10 times more administrators in the public school system than they did in the private school system. And that kind of difference is the same kind of difference you'd see if you had private companies owning the roads and running the roads. The money wouldn't be wasted on people that just shuffle paper like they do in the public institutions, because there's a wage benefit. The more people you have under you, the higher salary you can command as a as an administrator in the any kind of government. So that's what their incentive is to do, is to grow their programs. Drew, do you have anything to add before we go on to point number two?
Well, I don't want to steal your thunder.
Go ahead.
Well, one thing that I like to add is that, you know, we didn't have an interstate system until the Eisenhower administration. And from what I've read, the Eisenhower administration wanted to have a system in place similar to the German Autobahn so that they could move military equipment cross-country very swiftly.
True.
And so that's how we ended up with all these interstates. This was military infrastructure, but it was sold to the public, you know, in such a way that they'd want it so they could, you know, travel quickly from point A to point B on better, faster roads, and it would enhance interstate commerce, which sounds good, but if you look at, you know, some of the most tyrannical things that the government does, is in the name of interstate commerce and their ability to govern that through the Commerce Clause of the Constitution, you know, so that it just facilitated more power to the state. And so what's happened through all of this is we've ended up with an entire culture that's dependent upon the wheeled automobile. And, you know, cities are designed on grids. Everything's based, you know, the economy's based on the automobile. Everything's tied to the petrodollar. That's changing, of course. I don't want to get into that at this point. But so we've become a society completely dependent upon roads and completely dependent upon wheeled automobiles. And I don't want to jump ahead, you know, on your presentation, but this dependency, I think, has stifled innovation, and it has limited human progress on a major scale.
Yeah, I would agree with that, and we're going to discuss that in a little more detail. I want to, on this second part here, I want to now kind of describe how private roads are designed, what criteria is used, and how they're paid for in countries that use private road ownership. Now, I did a little bit of research earlier this year on the road system in Chile. And in Chile, not all the roads are privately owned, but a lot of the ones that connect larger population centers are. And they have kind of a unique way of funding that. What they do is the companies that are going to buy, are going to do the roads, they buy all the property first. They acquire all the property they're going to need, and they do that through voluntary exchange. They make an offer. If the person says no, then they'll either think of a different route or they'll offer more money, you know, whichever's going to, up to a point. And they always make economic decisions. It's not, and if the people aren't willing to sell, then they go around their property. But it's not, no one's forced into a sale. They sell if they want, they don't if they don't want. They plan their roads so that they have these little centers, just like Denny Hastert did, where they have gas stations and restaurants and motels and convenience stores and things that you would expect if you pulled off a major highway. They continue to own the land. They lease the land to people to build these structures and put these businesses in place, and then they take a percentage of the business that these people generate, and that funds the entire road system, the profits of the roadside businesses. And so people can drive on that with no fee at all. It's just like it's a public road. There are other places in the world where they have, and this is in the United States even, where they have sections of the roads they may be still publicly owned, but they work on toll systems where you have to pay to use the road. And close to where we live, the best example of this is in the Bay Area. To go into San Francisco, you have to either have to drive all the way around down to San Jose and then come up through that peninsula to get into San Francisco, or you can go across these bridges for a small toll. And it's not very expensive. I think it's a good deal. And a lot of cars that are like from Oregon, like when I go down there, I stop and I wait in line to pay my toll and go across the bridge. But a lot of the cars, they subscribe to a service where they put a reader on their car and they have a sensor or whatever. And they're sensed as they go through. It identifies the car and it creates a bill. And every month they get a bill from the bridge authority, which tells them how much they owe for going across the bridge during that month, and they pay that. And that system works very well too, and pay for usage type of thing. And I'm sure that that could be adapted to any private road as well. And so that's another way that these roads could be constructed, and it's completely voluntary. You don't have to go through the thing if you don't want to be on the road. And if you don't want to pay the thing, you can choose another way to get there. But it's not, no one's being forced to do it. You have to go across the road and you have to pay the toll. You can do something else if you want to. So that this entire system is much more peaceful. No one is forced to pay a tax that they don't, if they don't drive, or they aren't using general funds to fix things along here that for people that take public transit, or your gas tax money that you pay is supposed to go to roads isn't diverted to public transit, and so on and so forth. It's all done on the up and up, and it's a clean system. And it's the places that I've investigated where it's working, it seems like it's very simple and easy to work, and the people that are managing it are actually making a profit instead of wasting taxpayer money like the government does. So that was the second part. Do you have anything to add there too?
Well, you know, the whole process with these major road developments, you know, and I'm not talking about a road through your neighborhood. You know, I'm talking about the freeways and the highways. You know, the people in the communities that they supposedly serve really don't have any say in these projects, how they're designed, whether they're going to be built or not built. And the government just placates to the citizenry. They make them think that they have a say. Community groups get formed, can show up at meetings to voice an opinion or whatever, but it doesn't matter. Ultimately, the Federal Highway Administration will determine if a project is going to get built through your community or not. And some organization, you know, like Our Town's Pedestrians, or organization of local businesses, or Chamber of Commerce, or whatever. I mean, they could complain and make wishes or whatever, but it's not going to matter. Ultimately, the FHA will decide. Even the state really doesn't have a say if they're taking federal money, which is going to almost always be the case. And so these projects will get done, and they'll be done on a huge scale. One thing that really disturbs me with some of the projects that have happened and are happening around the area where we live in Jefferson is that these, that they're overbuilt. You know, the capacity is overbuilt, you know, in order to handle the traffic needs going out for, say, 30 years. But these structures themselves are only going to last for, say, 40 years. So by the time the project is finally up to capacity, it only has 10 years left before it's going to need to be replaced. You know, we saw this with the intersection at Barnett Road in right. Medford, Oregon. I mean, it just got to, you know, I grew up there, got to basically experience that whole entire project, and we're seeing, you know, similar problems with the entire viaduct that splits Medford in half, and
the freeway originally wasn't even supposed to go through Medford, but the one of the most powerful people in the state, Glenn Jackson, was a member of the country club, and he thought that the original route for the freeway was just too close to the country club and would diminish the value of the country club and the homeowners around the country club. And so he pushed to have it go a different route, which has been just a horrible decision from day one. It's just, like I said, it split the town in two. It's like it's the same thing as having a river running through your town.
Yeah.
There's no way you can cross it. You got to go under it or over it. Or it's a major blockage of movement of people and services and equipment. And it's a mess.
Well, another thing I'd like to add about the state's power when it comes to these projects is, they have the power to acquire land that they need for these projects through eminent domain, but they could also go back and change how existing properties that they didn't acquire, they could change how those properties are used and how much traffic, say, the commercial properties are generating. And this is completely outrageous because the owners of those properties are not compensated in any way.
This is a takings.
Yeah, it is a takings, but they're not compensated for it. And in some cases, they aren't even aware of new restrictions that will be created because their property is served by a government-owned road. And of course, you know, this is what's ridiculous, is the government, you know, is building a project to increase capacity while at the same time restricting usage. How insane is that? It doesn't even make sense.
If you're going to restrict the usage, you could have kept your old intersection or overpass.
Why didn't you build it? If it can't handle the current usage, how is it going to meet the demands for the future? It doesn't make sense whatsoever. But they're telling you how you're going to be able to use your property that you bought before the project was even thought of.
Yeah.
And it was built in accordance with the local zoning at the time. How can they do such a thing? But they do, and this is the slippery slope that you go down when you look to the government to build your roads.
It certainly is. And if it was privately done, there would be no such thing happening at all, because a private company would not have the authority, ability, or power to tell people how to use their property. Period.
Exactly.
So it just, we would think, well, who would be stupid enough to let their government tell them that?
Well, think about this. Think about this. If a private road was either funded by profits from the businesses who would like want the road, right? They'd like, right. Yeah, well, we want a road. We're going to get more business. Okay, build it so we could have the maximum amount of customers possible, right?
That's right.
Doesn't that make sense?
Yeah.
Or if it was a private road, well, you know, that was owned by somebody else, well, you know, that's going to be paid by users. They would want the maximum number of vehicles coming through their road to get the maximum amount of profits, right?
Right.
So again, they would build it to the needs, the current and future needs, without any restrictions. Why would you want to put restrictions on your road? You'd want as many cars as possible coming through that thing. But not when the state builds the road. It's the opposite. They're going to build it out so it exceeds the current demand going out for decades to come and restrict it at the same time. And the reason is because they have poor planning further on down the line. They're like, well, we can't have too much traffic coming through this road because then it's going to affect this road, and we haven't figured out what's going to happen over there at that intersection.
And the final irony is, in 5 years, there'll be different people in all these positions in the government. They'll have different opinions. They'll have different things. And once again, we will have to adjust to their whims at great cost to whoever has a business and whatever they decided they want to disrupt, because they have no conscience about that,
right.
and they will. They will disrupt life and profits and businesses and, you know, your ability to make a living, and without any guilt at all. This project that Drew is talking about is taking place just a little bit south of where we live, and Drew has to drive by it every day on his way to work, and I get to drive by it a couple times a week, and
I get to deal with the guys who build the roads.
Yeah, he's actually seen that there are actually people that do this. That I'm sure that they would also wouldn't mind working for private companies that do it also. But to finish the point, these people only work an 8-hour day, 5 days a week. There's no double shifts. There's a lot of businesses being severely disrupted because of the it's hard to get to the businesses that are at that exit on the freeway at this time. It's confusing, and it's kind of temporary roads and signage. And, you know, I had to go through it a couple times before I figured out where I was supposed to turn. I kept going the wrong, getting in the wrong road and going, where am I going now? And I wasn't paying enough attention to what's going on. So a lot of people just avoid it because it's confusing. Traffic gets blocked up with people like me turning around to go back the other way. But all this could be changed if they could work two or three shifts a day. They could have it done in half or a third the time they're going to get it done now. It would cost them a little bit more, but that cost would be offset by a tremendous amount of commerce that's going to take place. It's not taking place now. When I had my store in the mall here in Medford, they did a bridge project to fix the bridge, which really needed to be fixed. I mean, it was not in good shape. And they expanded it from two lanes to four lanes, and it was a big project. It took a long time. They did it half a bridge at a time so they could keep traffic flowing. But I swear I never saw more than three or four people working at a time, and they only worked, like I said, one shift a day, and it took about 2.5 years to finish that project. And during that time, my business at my store was down about 30% during that whole time. And a lot of that business was very difficult to get back. I never did get all of it back because we kind of went into recession about the time I was getting close to getting back to where I was before they started the bridge construction. And that's how they do. They have no concern. They don't see beyond their own budget of their own department. They don't see there's any kind of consequence to their actions, or an unintended consequence, or some other effect that's happening because of the way they're disturbing the way commerce and traffic flows now. And they don't see that extra time and effort that they could put into putting multiple shifts on a job and getting it done faster could actually be better for an economy than the way they do it now, by trying to get the cheapest thing for the taxpayers. Well, what they're doing is they're saving a whole bunch of people pennies, and they're putting those savings are minuscule, and the people that actually have businesses, and there's a large car dealership that suffered. There, it wasn't just my business; all the businesses in the mall suffered. There's a large shopping area that's just on the other side of that bridge. The traffic was just a mess for 2.5 years at that intersection, or around that intersection, around that bridge. And there's a lot of businesses that were around there that were affected, and they lost tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of dollars each. And there are a lot of businesses. There's well over 100 businesses in that area. So it was a ton of money. And they paid for all those savings of the taxpayers that were pennies in the individual taxes. They paid for all that with their losses in their business, in their commerce. And it was just horrible. And it's a horrible decision-making process. And if it was a private road, they would want to maintain the goodwill and cooperation of the people they were serving. That's part of how businesses operated, or they used to anyway, before we entered into fascism. But it used to be the integrity was something that they taught in business school. This was an important thing for people to understand how important that was, to have some honor, to be trusted, to be honest, and how that impacted or how that improved your chances of being successful as a business person. They don't deal with that anymore. Well, we got a few minutes left. I want to just make out a couple of comments. Drew started on this point. I'll make a comment and I'll let him finish it, because I think he's got a lot of great ideas about how things can do. But right now, a lot of this money that's being funneled into government roads is wasted money. And it's not that we don't need the roads. It's the government wastes everything that they do. They are tax eaters. They aren't providing an infrastructure that couldn't be provided for less money and a better quality by someone else in a private setting. So anything that they do is just, you got to think of it as it's a waste, because that's all it is. We're paying more for something that isn't as good as what we could have had for a lower price in a private society. All this capital that's being wasted could be invested in developing better technologies for higher gas mileage. They don't want higher gas mileage because they're getting their revenues from cars burning gas. They get their 50 cents, 55 cents a gallon in tax revenue. So if cars use half as much gas, they're losing a lot of money. So that, they don't really have an incentive to really back that up. I mean, they say they give the car companies these mandates, but they really don't want that to happen because they need that revenue to keep the roads up. If they were doing a private system, the private system would never do it the way the government's doing it. There would be either being billed for usage, like you get billed on your cell phone, or there'd be some sort. There'd be rent from businesses along the highways, and whatever they chose to do, it would be a smooth, simple system that was easily done and paid for, and there would be no restrictions or no. No friction in trying to get better technologies into the transportation industry. Presently, there is, because there's a lot of people who have, it's going to be hard to get a raise if you're in charge of this transportation division of a state roads thing, because if gas economies continue to get better, and I just read about this new Volkswagen car they're not allowing in the United States that gets over 300 miles a gallon, and it's only being made in Europe. It quote unquote doesn't meet the safety standards of the United States. Sure. Okay. So, Drew, you talk some more to this thing about technology
it stifles stopped. Innovation because basically, I mean, can anybody out there, tell us how much a mile of interstate costs to build? Nobody knows. Nobody really knows how much that costs. How can you figure that out? You know, there's so many taxes involved, and this state agency's paying this much, and this federal organization is paying this much, and where's the money coming from? Nobody really knows. So everybody is led to believe that this is the most efficient way to do things. This is the most efficient way to construct roads and to get people and goods from point A to point B. And what that has done is that it has stifled innovation, in my opinion. You know, what it has done is made it more expensive for competing technologies to come about. You know, maybe if it weren't for government subsidized roads, government built roads, we would have inexpensive flying cars, or at least land speeders. I mean, look at Luke Skywalker's land speeder from Star Wars. That thing was a pile of crap. I mean, but it didn't need a road. If there was a pothole underneath it, you know, from a Bantha or whatever, it wouldn't matter. It'd just glide over the top of it. But no, we're still using these wheeled vehicles, you know, and it reminds me of my great grandmother telling me about the first car that she saw. Horseless carriage in the early 1900s, and how amazing it was to her. And here we are; we're still rolling around in cars. You know, maybe 3D printing would have advanced, and we'd be able to not just move data to produce, you know, small things, but large things, or even food, or transport people, or whatever. Teleportation.
Yeah, and there've already been people have come up with flying cars in Europe. They've been successfully built and flown. They've tested them out. That they work. They might be a little more expensive than the mass market can afford at this point in time. But how much sooner could we have a technology like this if we didn't have the government siphoning off all this money?
Exactly. That's the point of my rant right there. Didn't mean to sound like a crazy man.
Oh no, you didn't. It all makes perfect sense. And we get in these habits of just trusting the government for all of our solutions, and they're the worst place we could go. Well, I hear the music, so it's time to go. Thanks for listening, everybody. Join us next week. We're going to have a replay of last year's Thanksgiving episode, a full 2 hours of history and economics. Oh, boy.
Can't wait.
You're bound to break one more time.